Hello and welcome to Books on the Go, a podcast where we talk about our book of the week. I'm Anna Bailey-Karras and I'm here with Annie Waters. Hi, Annie.
Hello.
And this week we've been reading Lost Children Archive by Valeria Luiselli. But first, book news, and we're back with the awards.
So many of them.
So many. An exciting announcement that the Stella Prize has been won by Vicky Lovo-Harvey for The Erratics.
Mm, not my pick, but no. I haven't read it, so I'm keen to. I bought it today, so I will dive in. You've read it though.
Yes, and we might discuss it on the podcast, but yeah. I had read it. I read Axiomatic and then I read The Erratics, and it was so interesting because, I mean, obviously Axiomatic I knew was your pick and I loved reading it, but I read The Erratics and just thought, wow, this is amazing.
Oh, great.
And I nearly tipped it. Like I'd only read those two of the list, but I thought this could actually, it very much stands up against Axiomatic.
Yeah, wow.
And cool. So I wasn't surprised that it won, but I was quite thrilled because I it's a really nice story.
Wonderful. And she's what, in her 50s?
70s, I think.
70s, oh my gosh. And it's her first book.
I could be wrong. I don't want to age her.
Amazing. Yeah. No. The story of the publication of the book is amazing.
I know.
Let alone the story of the book itself. So, because it was out of print with her publisher.
It was almost out of print because the publisher closed down and then it was long-listed for the Stella Prize.
Yeah, so they picked up by HarperCollins. So it's wonderful news and a very deserving winner by the sounds of it.
It is.
And it is always nice. I do like to see a book that hasn't had the recognition that it perhaps deserves get that kind of spotlight shone onto it.
Yeah.
Because I think perhaps Axiomatic is at the point where everyone who's read it has read it maybe.
Yes, I know what you mean.
Whereas this, is thrusting a totally new author into the spotlight, which is wonderful.
So. And I can't wait to see what she does next, actually.
Absolutely.
So that was the Stella Prize, very exciting. And over in the States, the Los Angeles Times Awards have been announced. And just a couple of notable ones. For fiction, Rebecca Mackay won for The Great Believers,
wonderful.
Which is wonderful.
Yes, which we read and then spoke to Rebecca several episodes ago.
Yeah. So that was lovely news. And Oyin Khan Braithwaite's My Sister the Serial Killer won for the crime thriller category, which again, very deserving. And we read that a few episodes ago and really enjoyed that one as well. And she was a delight to chat to. And in this, there were a couple of interesting ones in the nonfiction. One is called Dope Sick, which won the Science Award. And that's all about prescription medicine or pain relief
and the opioid
addiction.
Crisis.
That, which sounds sort of depressing but fascinating.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's quite relevant to our situation as well. I think we have perhaps not to the same extent, but across regional Australia.
You mean in Australia, Annie's and my situation.
Yeah. No, well, no. I can't speak for you. But
So that sounded interesting. And the other one was In Current Events, a book called The Line Becomes a River, Dispatches from the Border, which might be topical for us talking about this book today as well. But I think that discusses the US-Mexico border.
Yeah, I think the person who wrote that was a border guard for many years, and so it's writing from his perspective. Francesca Cantu, I think his name is.
Yeah,
the things that he's seen and the things that he's had to do.
Yeah, so quite interesting. Mm. That's also a topic that comes up with our book today, Lost Children Archive. So this is by Valeria Luiselli, who was born in Mexico City, but she has mainly lived in the States. I think they travelled very widely when she was younger, so she's lived in South Korea, South Africa, and India as well. But she's based in New York City, and she wrote a novel called Faces in the Crowd and then The Story of My Teeth. Mm. And that's the one where I heard about her. And I actually had read a book by Alvaro Enrique, I think his name is, called Sudden Death, which was quite experimental fiction about a royal tennis match between Caravaggio and a famous Spanish poet whose name escapes my memory. And the ball was made from Anne Boleyn's hair, and it was this really interesting, and then it weaves in stories about the Aztecs, I think it was, and the Conquisitor, like this really interesting, like it's a book that is memorable to me, and quite meaty prose, but he was married to Valeria Luiselli, and that, then I saw that she'd written The Story of My Teeth, which the title alone kind of grabs you. But I was so intrigued by thinking, well, wonder what she, you know, what she's written, and I never got to reading it. And then she had a essay called Tell Me How It Ends, an essay in 40 questions, which is all about her work. She helped as a translator children who'd come across the border into the United States and were unaccompanied minors and needed help filling out the questionnaire. And so she was, she felt very strongly about this, the situation that they're in, and wanting to help them but also angry about it. And she ended up, I think she was working on this novel, the one Lost Children Archive, but she ended up having so much to say that was really non-fiction that she wrote Tell Me How It Ends, which won the National Book Award, I believe.
I read that described as a polemic rather than a
much more of a polemic.
And,
And I didn't get to read that either. And then I saw Lost Children Archive had come out and it was long-listed for the Women's Prize, and I thought, right, this is my chance.
You've got to do it.
I've been so intrigued to read about, to read her work. And she's a really intelligent woman. She's quite academic. She's obviously a very humane, compassionate person who's deeply troubled by the crisis at the border of the US and Mexico, where you have children coming over on freight trains and they call it La Bestia, where they're riding on top of the trains and in quite perilous circumstances. And then when they arrive, they either get deported or sometimes shot at by the sound of it, or, you know, they can easily come into harm's way or perish in the desert, or really unsafe conditions for these children. She very much touches on that. But Lost Children Archive is actually the story of a couple who are based in New York who take a road trip with his son and her daughter, who are their sort of reformed family, I suppose, and they take a road trip because her husband has taken up a job down in the Apache Mountains, and they're sound documentary makers, or they document sounds, and he's taken a job there, and he doesn't seem to care really if that means that they become separated, in a sense, because he's not asking her to go with him, but she decides to go with him. They pack up 7 or 9 archive boxes in the car with things that they'll take on the journey, and they go with the children, and the marriage is sort of breaking down. So the story is really about, it's a road trip, and it's about that marriage and the effect on the children. And then at some point in the novel, not halfway through, but at some stage, the narrator becomes the stepson, and you hear about this from the children's point of view and the actions that they take. But also the narrator in the story, a bit like Valeria Luiselli, has been helping an immigrant called Manuela, who has been separated from her children, and the narrator is wondering what's happened to Manuela's children, and she's worried about that. That's very much occupying her mind while she's on this journey. And it's quite the book is written in a not quite stream of consciousness, but it's all the narrator's thoughts and just small details of what they do in their day to day. And then there'll be extracts of lists of things that are in their boxes that they've brought with them, and there'll be little almost non-fiction extracts or elements to the novel as well. So it's quite an interesting form. What did you think, Annie?
I am still figuring out what I think about it. I'm compelled to keep reading, so I still haven't quite finished. I'm probably, I don't know, 100 pages from the end. I feel like it's all very real and it's making me think a lot. I still don't know if I enjoy it or not, but I'm definitely intrigued and fascinated by it. But it's not a quick read, and I've been reading it for a week, and usually a book this size I would power through, but I'm finding it, I can only dip in and out of it quite briefly. I think partly because none of the characters are named. So there's the woman who's the narrator, there's her husband, and then there's the two children, the boy and the girl.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I think Manuela is one of the only characters who gets a significant name. But then there's lots of philosophers and artists and writers that are name dropped.
Lots.
especially in the first kind of 50 to 100 pages, I found that quite overwhelming, and I felt a bit alienated from that. I didn't know necessarily their work or even who they were. So that was a bit disorienting. But now that I'm properly into the story, now that they're on the road and they're moving towards a purpose, I think I'm enjoying it more. I like the documentary style form that kind of represents their documentary jobs. I think it's all a bit highbrow.
Yes.
For me. But yeah. I do feel it as well. I think that highbrow work can sometimes be alienating emotionally, and I do feel things with this book, but it's taken me a little while to get to that point.
Yes.
If you know what I mean.
I bailed on this book.
I know.
And I'm quite happy to confess that, because I think it's important. It's something, and we'll talk about this with Sean Mooney, who's coming on as a guest of the podcast next week or the week after to talk about Flames. And Sean is a notorious bailer. He describes himself as the queen of bailing, and he's very good at articulating why he does, and he finds it liberating. And it's not something I do lightly, but I do think that if you're not enjoying a book, don't keep reading it because life's too short.
Yeah,
and
I know
speaking for myself, and I'm sure all of our listeners are the same, a huge stack of books that I'm dying to read, and you know, I just I'm going to run out of time, and new books keep coming out every week that I'll be excited to read as well, and I can't keep up with that. So, like, it's a luxury for me to have time to read. So in the morning I might get 10 minutes while, the kids are getting ready for school, and I've got the book sitting on the kitchen table, and if I'm not looking forward to getting back to that book, and if it feels like a chore, well, that's, you know, there's something
wrong.
You
have to carve out time that it feels like a duty. And
good. That's a really rare treat for me to have that 10 or 15 minutes, and inevitably it doesn't pan out very peacefully, and I've got kids screaming they want their lunchbox or whatever, but I aspire to it. And I found with this one, it wasn't easy to make the decision, because there's so much that I admire about the book, and as you say, it's one that I have kept thinking about, and I think I can see why some people have fallen in love with it, and why all those different references and things that give it texture, and she's included Polaroid photographs at the end, for example, and it feels very layered and textured, and I see how people could really love that and want to keep sort of flicking backwards and forwards in the book, and the experience can be quite immersive. And she, on every page there was a turn of phrase or an observation or a quote that was really interesting and, that I liked. But I found that it didn't have dramatic tension.
Yeah.
And as you say, you're waiting for them to move towards a purpose. But yeah, I didn't feel like I was being told a story.
I think you're almost living her life alongside the narrator, which, as you say, is really immersive, and does then, once you kind of get into the story, you know all these characters so well, except the husband. You never get close really to him, which I think is probably representative of their drifting apart. You kind of know what he's like, but you don't know who he is. He says barely anything. He just tells these stories and sounds like a bit of a bore.
Yeah, and he does, doesn't he?
Just goes on and on.
I do wonder whether it was based on her now ex-husband in real life.
Well, it feels very, I think it's one of those books where it feels the more you learn about her, you think,
it's gone into the book.
Yeah. And I think at the back she's got a little note on her sources and the way that she's used other documents, because she's woven lots of different documents in. She's made up this book, a little red book, which is called The Elegies of the Lost Children. And there's no, I don't think that is a real book, but
she's
kind of pieced that together from lots of other different fragments of texts. And I really liked that.
Yeah.
And I think, it is like a palimpsest, and I guess a more emotional way of telling the story of these children who are lost, because the narrator keeps trying to find a way to tell the story of these children who get separated from their families, thousands and thousands of children who just become numbers. And I think in her mind, that's not enough to just report on. It needs to be documented in a different way.
Yeah, I can see the struggle, and I like the honesty of that. But I think where I struggled, it didn't cut through for me. It didn't reach me because I felt as if the narrator or the author, what is troubling her is these lost children coming across the border. And yet the story she gives us, instead of giving us, for example, the story of Manuela's children, she gives us a story of this couple from New York whose marriage is in trouble, but juxtaposed against the real peril that these children are in, the marriage breakdown, and as you say, the husband is a bit of a non-character and she's not overly sympathetic. So the marriage breakdown, I didn't have any sense of, and I didn't even sense whether the narrator really cared whether the marriage survived.
It felt like a fait accompli, I think, that you kind of get the potted history of their relationship and then it's like, but it's done now because he's moving and I'm going to follow him because I've never been a person who's good at ending things, but I know that we should.
Yeah.
But I
think that felt anticlimactic. Yeah. It didn't have any tension for me to want to keep turning the page because I didn't care. It wasn't like it was a dual storyline with the Manuela's children and this marriage and you really kind of, wow, I wonder what will happen.
No,
today he's being nice to her, but the next day he's didn't, you know, or you're following day by day. It's just, as you say, it feels a bit like a fait accompli. Yeah. I know from interviews with Valeria Luiselli, she's said she felt she couldn't appropriate the lost children's stories and make that her novel.
Yep.
I think she really, I mean, this is someone who thinks very deeply about how she approaches a project, and which I really respect. But it's just that the novel as a whole, as a result, for me, I didn't.
Well, so then I
felt like that was what was troubling her, and yet that wasn't the story she gave us.
Yeah.
That's how it
read. I think she then kind of
me.
Put those concerns onto the two children in the book,
yes.
the couple's
and
children.
And then I don't know if is it a spoiler to say what the children do?
Well, I read a Guardian article in which it was in the first paragraph, I don't think so.
So the children run away.
Yeah.
And then they end up, it seemed to me, because I did, having said that I bailed, which I did as my duties to the podcast, of course, are paramount. So I did then skim through to the end just to see what happened. So I have a sense of the whole book. And the children seem to be travelling on top of the trains with the Central American children.
So, yeah.
And I just found that a bit off, to be honest.
Yeah, so they're the children from the elegies, it kind of merges.
Oh, no. Okay, this is where the skimming is
metaphysical.
Okay.
Or, yeah.
This is the danger of skimming, okay, because I thought it was her children and then they get given a granola bar at the end.
It's like, so her children run away, but then they somehow intersect with the children from the story that she's telling the children. So it does become a little bit metaphysical, or I don't know, but you're hearing that from the boy's perspective. So it's almost as if, and he and the sister have, the sister-in-law, half-sister,
step-sister,
have been making up stories the whole time in the back. So you're not quite sure. He's not a reliable narrator, even though he's presenting himself as this documentarian. He's only 10.
Yeah, no, he's only young.
He's upset by the fact that his parents are clearly drifting apart. Yeah, so.
Okay, well, that makes it more interesting.
I think it definitely picks up steam towards the end of the novel. Like,
yeah.
I think the plot, as much as there is, kicks in and it becomes more interesting stylistically.
And it's you know, the writing is really strong and her observations are beautiful. Mm. Some of the way, you know, she observes the interaction of the children and what happens to children when they don't have parental supervision.
I think that's.
And the vulnerability of the children.
I think that's what it was about for me. What is the responsibility of a parent to a child, and how do you navigate parenthood? And I'm not a parent, so I don't necessarily have well-formed opinions about this, but how can you parent a child in the world that we live in, that there are so many horrible things that exist that the narrator doesn't want to shy away from necessarily? She thinks that's duplicitous, and she sees her children as equals to her intellectually and morally, but she also wants them to have a childhood, and how do you walk that line between those two things? And they do have very intelligent and highbrow conversations with this 10-year-old and a 5-year-old that make some beautiful moments of honesty. And it's almost, I don't know, I wonder whether her point is that the youngest person in this book sometimes sees the world most clearly and can express herself most clearly. And then as we grow up and put layers and layers on things and try to document the world and make sense of it, we lose that truth or we lose that honesty.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm still trying to think about what it's about.
A good reading of it. And it does open up. There's a lot to think about and there's so much. It's a very rich book in that way, but just didn't get through to me really. But as you say, I think it probably does pick up a bit towards the end as a story, whereas that's what was lacking for me at the beginning. And the academic references, and I don't mind an academic reference, but it did feel academic. It felt like she'd put in everything that she was thinking for the novel and then it was like a brain dump, and then she hadn't
contextualized that or
hadn't been sort of whittled down to what do we really need for the story.
Yeah.
And I guess that's an interesting discussion about, well, what should a novel be? Should it just be a story or can you do more with it? So I like that she's playing around with the form.
Yeah.
It just was a bit too dense for me, bit too highbrow.
And it's interesting thinking about the professions of the two adults. They both sound, one calls himself a documentarian and she's a documentarist, and the difference being one of them is like a librarian and just collects things and then, you know, keeps them, and the other one shapes the story more.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, I would not listen to either of your documentaries.
Now, can I just share with you, this is the sort of point that I stopped reading. The child asks her, Ma, what does it mean to document stuff?
Mm-hmm.
And you or I might think, you know, it's to make a record of something. Mm-hmm. So whether you're drawing it or writing it down or
photographing it or whatever.
Photographing it or recording it, the sound of it, so you have a record of it. Maybe, is that the sort of thing? So her answer is, perhaps I should say that documenting is when you add thing plus light, light minus thing, photograph after photograph, or when you add sound plus silence, minus sound, minus silence. What you have in the end are all the moments that didn't form part of the actual experience, a sequence of interruptions, holes, missing parts, cut out from the moment in which the experience took place. Because experience plus a document of the experience is experience minus one. The strange, it does go on, but I'll stop there. That's a roundabout where I just put the book down and I can't. I just can't.
Fair.
But I love that her mind thinks that way.
Yeah.
It just, as a novel, it didn't work for me. I think I will perhaps go back and read the essay because as a non-fiction writer, I think she'd be amazing. Mm. That's where it just was one.
Fell apart for you.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Yeah. I think if you're not someone who needs a plot to drive your novel, which, you know, some people aren't.
No, absolutely.
If you like a novel of ideas and beautiful sentences and really interesting structure that is talking about some really important contemporary issues, you'll love this book. But you need time to read it. You know, this book could take you a month or a year to read, and I think you'd keep finding things.
Yeah, maybe that's the way to slow down the I was
because
too
it is in
impatient.
Little fragments, you know, every chapter. Yeah. There's several parts to the book, and each part has a different kind of subheading, and then within that there's subheadings within subheadings. So I think you could just dip in and out of it and take it really slowly and ponder it a bit more.
Well, the New York Times' Parul Segal says the novel becomes truly novel again in Lewis Ellie's hands, electric, elastic, alluring, new. She's a superb chronicler of children. NPR says daring, wholly original, brilliant, fascinating. She has pulled off a twist on the great American road trip novel. The New Yorker, James Wood, engrossing, constantly surprising, a beguiling mixture of the real and the doubly invented, a passionately engaged book with intellectual amplitude and moral seriousness, and a beautiful, loving portrait of children.
That's true. The children shine in this. I loved that five-year-old. She's so funny and just cuts through the parents' bullshit in such hilarious ways. I just read a bit where she tells the best joke that she has, which is what did the knock-knock joke say to the other type of joke?
Oh,
and the whole family says, what? And she says, knock, knock. And they say, who is it? And she says, knock, knock. And they say, who is it? And then they all just burst about laughing. And it is so true of children and that strange way that their mind works, that there is a logic there, but it's not any kind of adult logic.
No, no, no. And what they think is funny. And then the Washington Post, an epic road trip. Her mind is a delight. Her writing shimmers. So it's absolutely been lauded and praised. And I think there's a lot to like about it, and it's very rich and rewarding. But I've put it down for now.
It may never return.
So that was Lost Children Archive by Valeria Luiselli. And next week, Amanda and I will be back reading Spring by Ali Smith, the new one in the Brexit Quartet or the Seasonal Quartet. And then Andy and I are reading Flames by Robbie Arnott with Sean Mooney. So stay
tuned. Very excited for that.
That'll be really fun.
Let's hope it gets past chapter one.
Yeah. So we will see you then. And in the meantime, you can follow us on Facebook at Books on the Go and email us at booksonthegopodcast@gmail.com. And I'm on Twitter, Instagram and Litzy at A. Bailey Harris. And Annie?
And I'm on the same three at Mr. _Annie. Thanks very much.
We'll see you next week. Bye for now.
Bye.